Good morning, all you holiday makers out there. We're well into the winter. You know, I had a question.
Go ahead. You have a question.
Why is it Mother Nature but Old Man Winter?
Yes, what about it?
Why is it? Why is Mother Nature and then it's Old Man Winter?
Well, I think
we don't like winter.
I think it's a mischaracterization, as always. So the men are always to blame.
Oh, dear.
The ladies are always perfect. So Mother Earth is always perfect, but Old Man Winter is always really nasty.
Well,
there's some people who like Old Man Winter. I never did understand that.
Yeah, I don't like him. He's old.
Yeah, yeah, you don't like him. And the reason people like to ski and ice skate is that's the reason it's snow and icy. If people didn't like to do that, it wouldn't be nice and warm.
Right, exactly. We'd move someplace else.
I've always felt that way. But anyway, let's get back to the subject.
I mean, a lot of people out there are still buying presents for the holidays. And boy, what a treasure trove of cookbooks are out there this season.
There are.
One more gorgeous than the next.
But the one we're going to talk about now is
probably the Ne Plus Ultra Gorgeous Cookbook of the season.
This one is not just for the Christmas season. This is a cookbook for all seasons by two fascinating young men who are telling us about a fascinating new adventure in addition to their cookbook and their approach to the restaurant 11 Madison Park. They were also announced in our interview, you'll hear that coming up if you listen carefully, that they, this very day that we interviewed them, which is a couple of weeks ago, they were actually taking over ownership of 11 Madison Park, and 11 Madison Park is the name of their cookbook. So here's Daniel Hume
and Will Guidara. Well, I must say that I am in possession here of a very, very handsome book, the cookbook for 11 Madison Park. And as a matter of fact, we have a very handsome chef and manager and equally handsome food. The photographs pop out as rather extraordinary, and I was surprised to find the photographer actually is a trained culinarian. He's a food stylist, photographer, and master. How good is that, huh?
It definitely helped in the process to have somebody who really understands food.
Yeah, well, I think your restaurant is just terrific. And I wanted to back up a little bit. You have got a little complicated for me before I understood it. Just right after the Beard Awards last year where you took away the top restaurant award. And I might add that you all have all these other awards as well, including Best Chef New York. All of a sudden, then, I started hearing that you were starting another joint venture, not 11 Madison Park. And then when that registered my mind, I understand that you are actually, have you already, or are you going to buy out Danny Meyer's and be own 11 Madison Park?
So the new venture that we're partnering in is a hotel called the Nomad Hotel on 28th and Broadway.
Which sounds like a lot of fun.
Oh, we're so excited about it. It's our opportunity to show the other side of our personality. I think that our true passion lies in fine dining. But to have the opportunity to create another grand restaurant, although one that has an a la carte menu, the kind of place that you can stop in and enjoy a few times a week, something that has the capacity to create a little bit more community is something that we're really excited about. The team that we've put together over there and the people that we're partnered with over there, it's just going to be really special. So although that's still 5-6 months away, it's something that we're really looking forward to. 11 Madison Park won't change at all. We're opening another restaurant in addition to 11 Madison Park called The Nomad, which is a part of a hotel. And a concept that really kind of brings back a time in New York where hotels and restaurants were one, where it's not a restaurant within a hotel, but a unified brand. So you're either staying at the Nomad or eating at the Nomad or drinking at the Nomad. So you're talking to us on a really exciting day. Today is the day that we officially took over ownership of the restaurant.
Oh, that's great.
And that, Danny has been an unbelievable mentor, an incredible inspiration for us for many, many years. And, you know, one of the questions people have asked us recently is, what are you going to change about the restaurant now that you own it? And we've been blessed in that Danny has given us quite a bit of autonomy for a few years.
Right, so it's sort of what you wanted it to be up until now anyhow.
Yeah, the restaurant is exactly what we want it to be. And things that defines our restaurant is this idea of endless reinvention and constant evolution. And so the restaurant will continue to change, but in the exact same fashion it has been for the past few years.
Danny explains in his introduction, or his foreword, he explains how this all happened, and as I mentioned, it's very much in the European tradition where a restaurant blossoms and then the proprietor turns it over to his protege.
No, absolutely, and I think this is maybe the only way why there are restaurants in Europe are so at the top for general, like mostly in often they're family restaurants, and I think Danny and us, we have become like family, and I think he's just passing off the torch to us, and it's a beautiful thing, and we admire him for that as well, because it really means when we get older, we're going to be in a position, too, that we're happy about the next generation doing really well, and we're really thankful.
Well, of course, you are European, chef, and
yes,
and Daniel, whom was born in Switzerland, and I guess you interweave your story, and so does Will interweave both his and your stories into this book, which takes it way beyond just an ordinary cookbook. You get to understand the spirit of this place.
Absolutely. For us, it was important that we can put something into the world that reflects 11 Madison Park of today, because what we do always changes and we evolve, and it's very hard to capture a moment in a restaurant, and I think that a book is the only way you can really do that, and we're so proud, and I think it's one of the most beautiful cookbooks that we've seen, so we're really excited.
It's an absolute knockout. I mean, it really is.
Yeah, somebody described it as the most important cookbook of the year. I think it's probably a little bit more important than that.
Thank you very much. That means a lot.
But the amazing thing is that I'm thinking back now to when we were first reading about 11 Madison Park with Daniel at the helm, and some of the critics weren't very kind. You probably remember that. They, you know, the words like precious and altogether too beautiful and too contrived seemed to be words that people were expressing. And that must have been difficult, because I'm sure you knew exactly what you were doing, and the doing of it that's represented in this book is just wonderful.
Actually, what you're referring to is the debut of it, which is pre-Daniel.
Oh, I am. Okay. Yeah. I didn't realize that. Okay.
You know,
shows you how much I remember.
What I like is this list of words that you have for that are, I guess, what do you call it, your mantra.
And yeah, the words inspired by Miles Davis.
Well, yes, that's exactly it. And I happen to be a fan of, by the way. cool, endless reinvention, inspired, forward-moving, fresh, collaborative, spontaneous, vibrant, adventurous, light, and innovative. Now, that is all-encompassing for what you'd want everything in life to be.
Yeah, you know, when we first got here to the restaurant in 2006, our first review came from Moira Hodgson in the New York Observer.
Right.
And at the end of the review, and what was a reasonably good review, she said that we needed a bit more Miles Davis. And it came at a time when we were really looking for language, and, you know, we really believe in the importance of language to guide a team and a culture, and we were craving language to help express what we were trying to accomplish and where we were trying to go. And when we saw that, although we had no idea what it meant, we kind of felt like maybe there in that line was our language. And so we started reading as much as we could about Miles. And these 11 words were the ones that we found were popping up the most often. And so we made a list of those words, a big list, and we put it up in our office. And effectively, in the last 5 years, they've kind of been our guiding, I think, endless reinvention is, we talk about the idea of always evolving and changing, and cool with the idea of kind of bringing four-star dining to the new generation and making it accessible and fun and cool again. And they're really impactful words for us, and ones that we really believe in.
Well, now, the other phrase that jumped out at me was the another mantra called make it nice.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
That was actually the first phrase that Daniel learned when he moved to New York, when
America.
He moved to San Francisco.
Yeah, he didn't speak any English at all when he moved to San Francisco, right?
Yeah, which I'm totally inspired by, moving to a new country without speaking a language at all. But, you know, a chef needs to be able to communicate to the cooks to do better, and that was the phrase he learned. And so there is a big sign in our kitchen that says make it nice, and the name of the company that we've actually started, our new restaurant company, is called Made Nice.
Oh, nice. Now, let's talk about the book. You break it into the seasons, which is not a revolutionary concept. How do you make it very personal to you?
Well, there's a couple elements. I think the intertwining the narrative text within the season and having a team behind it be the exact team behind the restaurant. You know, normally a cookbook is the chef and a writer, and here it's the chef and the GM. I think it's the inclusion of an email address for people who require assistance.
Oh, I like that, by the way, that if somebody's got stuck with this recipe or any recipe, they could call you. How many people call?
The internet age, it felt like the right thing to do. You know, it's a book about a restaurant. Yes, first and foremost, it's a cookbook, but it tells the story of our entire restaurant.
Now we know about Daniel. Will, where did you emerge from into the world of 11 Madison Park?
I know we met.
I remember meeting you, but the thing I remember most about meeting you is that everything just moved perfectly. And you sort of seem to glide through the whole evening. And I'm guessing that you're very good at that. But how did you learn to do that?
Well, I come from a restaurant family. Actually,
right.
My dad, Frank Gadara, who is, I think most fathers have an impact in their sons' lives, but his has been paramount in mine. He is my biggest mentor, the person who I respect the most and aspire to be the most like.
And I bet he's proud of you, huh?
Yeah, he's pretty proud right now. But I've been, since I was a kid, I'd go to work with him, and it's just in my blood. Although it wasn't until working with Daniel that I realized I really wanted to be in fine dining.
Well, you're a dynamite duo, really. And, of course, Daniel's experience with his family is totally different. His father was an architect, and he was totally appalled at the idea that you were going to cook for a living, right, Daniel?
Yeah, no, he wasn't so happy about it. He felt like you work on the weekends and you work nights and you don't have a family life and all cooks are alcoholics. And
that too.
Yeah, so I just really wanted to prove him wrong, and I just loved to be in the kitchen the most very early on and worked very hard to not become one of those that he thought we all are, and I actually discovered a beautiful world in the kitchens and restaurants.
Now tell me this, in these sections, I'm looking at spring. Now it has those little icons, which I'm assuming are leaves of trees in the park, right?
Yep.
Yes.
And then you have lists of ingredients under
yep.
each one. Is there any further significance? These are ingredients that you attach to the season and use in these recipes?
I think these are ingredients that we love and that we use every season in different preparations. Also, the way that layout is exactly how our menu looks like, except it being a few less words. But the idea is that every dish is focused on a primary ingredient, and then the dish is built around that ingredient.
But that list is effectively the table of contents for the recipes that follow.
That's
Those are all the principal ingredients of the recipes within that.
Now, and you go through your recipes, and I want to get back to that, too, to ask you specifically to pull out some of these recipes that explain how people describe your style as sophisticated, refined, light, creative, exceptional. Could you pull out any recipes that you could sort of use to show how these apply? How about this caviar, poached oysters, champagne sauvignon, and watercress?
And I think the words on that list are more governing for just the way that we look at everything. So it's hard to say this dish is fresh, and this dish is light, and this dish is spontaneous. But for us, it's more that those words in culmination identify our perspective and the way that we look at everything. And so I think talk about fresh and collaborative and spontaneous. It informs the way that our entire team works. Jeff is the final barometer, but he works with his team to develop dishes. So it's hard to label them with one word or another.
Now, you have unusual sections in here. Of course, you mentioned the one with the equipment. Now, I don't know. I've actually wanted to try sous vide at home, but I haven't got around to doing that yet because I can get it in restaurants and much better done. And then you also have the basics, which you referred to, which I think people will really enjoy pulling out and adding to their repertoire for whatever recipes they're doing. You have some unusual, not chapters, like you have the section on gel.
Yeah, and that's in the back with the basics. Essentially, uh-huh. The gels are one of the building blocks of Daniel's food, and there's quite a few of them in the book, so they're all packaged together in one. And the idea is if a home cook doesn't have the time or the desire to cook an entire recipe in the form of one of these composed plates, they can pick a puree or an ice cream or a jus or a sauce or a powder or an ice cream or a gel and just do a few of the components to accentuate, you know, a dish that they're cooking on their own.
Can hardly get past the photographs, which are so luscious. Aren't they gorgeous? I mean, throughout the whole entire book. Let me ask you, this is unfair, but I'm going to ask Will, looking through, could you pick out some of your favorite recipes?
Recipes or pictures?
Recipes.
Recipes. Well, I was just saying this the other day that a friend of mine bought me a pasta maker at home, and this past Sunday I tried to make fresh pasta for the first time at home, and I called Chef and asked him to teach me how to make pasta, and he let me know that we had a pasta recipe right in the book, so that's the one recipe that I've actually done myself at home so far.
Yeah, we just got back from Sicily. We had a lot of fresh pasta.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
The things that I think are Daniel Hume classics are the honey lavender glazed Muscovy duck, or...
Oh, yeah, that's a winner.
The roast chicken that's in there is honestly one of my favorite dishes in the entire world, and I'm excited to try to make that at home. It's fun. You know, the co-author of the book, I'm still deriving pleasure out of challenging myself in my own kitchen to reproduce these dishes. And people say that, oh, these recipes are too hard. But I love cooking. I think a lot of people do. And sometimes the journey itself is most of the fun. It's not even about eating what you cook. It's about cooking what you cook and the meditative idea of just being in your kitchen and focusing on something. So the roast chicken, the duck, the granola is the best granola I've ever had. So
yeah, I mean, granola is a sort of a signature, isn't it?
It's become that, yes. Now, so those are my favorite dishes.
Now, this is an 11 Madison Park cookbook. Now, just in a few words, can you describe how the new restaurant's going to be different? You mentioned it earlier on, but I want to...
It's the Nomad.
Yes, it's the Nomad, but you said the Nomad will be an a la carte menu, but, I mean, will the style of the plates be different?
Yeah, I think this is a great question for Daniel.
You know, the food at Nomad is going to be a little bit more accessible. It will take less of a time commitment to eat at Nomad. We want people to be able to come 3-4 times per week. We will have some reservations and some not reservations. So it will be a little bit more lively in a sense that you can come for one plate, you can come for a full meal, you can come for a drink. And, you know, I'm really excited. We have an open heart oven. I've never had that in a restaurant. And so we're going to do beautiful roast chicken out of the open heart oven, some flatbread, and we'll also have, like, you know, this great smell in the dining room of, like, fresh bread, and we're really excited. Also, you know, breakfast we haven't done before, so this will also be new, and we want to take a different approach towards the breakfast menu and kind of make it really special, and I mean, we couldn't be more excited, and what's exciting is that it's only 4 blocks from 11 Madison.
Right, you can run back and forth.
Yeah, we can go back and forth.
Well, this is not only a beautiful, inspiring cookbook, it's also a very informative one and a good reference book. I mean, you run through a whole day at the restaurant, what happens at what time, so people
yes.
get a sense of that. You isolate all the different positions at the restaurant. I don't recall ever, unless it's a textbook, where all these positions and what they do are exactly described. And also you have a map showing where they work.
Yeah, and it's also interesting, I think, to see how big the kitchen is and how big the dining room is and how many people are actually behind creating these meals, because when you sit in the dining room, you probably don't realize how much it takes. And we just wanted to show that how every position is so, so important. And well, it's truly a team effort, you know.
Well, you described that in the book and with your meetings and so forth, and that was exciting for me to read, too. And
yeah.
I guess one other question is, you do have this section on moving forward.
Yes.
How do you move forward when everything is already so perfect?
I think we have a long way to go. You know, we have lofty aspirations. And
that's good.
Well, yeah, and I think I know that we can be more excellent. I know that we can be more hospitable. I know that we as a team can be more educated. But every year we get a little further down the road of truly defining our own point of view and establishing what it is that we stand for. And it's important to us that we're creating an experience that is intriguing and that has the ability to make impact.
Well, I think I'd add this cookbook to that too, because it celebrates this kind of a collaboration. And I think it's eye-opening, really, in so many ways. So everybody rush out and get this, called 11 Madison Park, The Cookbook. And congratulations, Daniel and Will.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, I can't wait to come and see you again.
Absolutely.
We look forward to seeing you both at the restaurant.
Thanks.
All right. Bye.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay.
And we're back. Our next guest, well, I think that the title of her book is a little quirky.
Her whole life story is a little quirky.
Borrowed and stolen is the title of the book.
Since we don't have her on the line right now, I can probably say her name's a little odd too. Allegra McEvedy. I mean, you'd have to interview somebody called Allegra McEvedy even if she didn't know anything. It's just such a fascinating name. But it turns out that in addition to lots and lots of culinary achievements, she also has a fascinating life story punctuated with stories about all the knives that seem to have characterized different stages of her career.
She collects knives one way or another, bought, borrowed, or stolen.
So let's hear her story.
That's the story. Allegra McEvedy, you are a chef, first of all, a writer, a broadcaster, and then I like this last bit. Culinary explorer, which anybody who gets a hold of your book called Bought, Borrowed, and Stolen, Recipes and Knives from a Traveling Chef, anybody will get your sense of venture, exploration, and so forth. One thing that I was a little curious about in the book, besides the title, I thought the title needs some explanation, which I'll let you do in a minute, but I opened my copy of the book, and until now, I have not met you. And it says your initials, AMCE. And then it says love with a little heart for the O, two with a little heart, eat, underscored. It looks like a personally autographed book, but obviously it's not.
Yes, and that came from, as you know, that I've been keeping food diaries since I was about 10 years old, and they form a very large element of the book. And so to go through, my designer went through all of these food diaries and just picked out little bits of recipes and drawings of these things that I'd seen all over the world that I just made little notes about. And then she found that. It was a title of a book that I was thinking about writing when I was about 11, and she just found it, and she just put it in there, and just like, oh, really, when she first did it. But I guess it's kind of cute, but to me it was never supposed to see the light of day.
Now, I love your table of contents, because all these various knives that you've collected serve for each chapter, and each chapter is a different place in the world in a time. Talk to us a little bit. You said, mentioned your diaries from age 10. Tell us why you ended up traveling and how you got to produce all these magnificent diaries that
carried on for years.
Well, it started with my dad, who was an historian. So when we went on family holidays from when I was, you know, a tiny girl, whereas most of my friends went to beach holidays or resorts or, you know, had those sorts of trips, we would go and we'd see Roman stadiums and churches and mosques and all sorts of things. You know, they were sort of packed with culture. And that was what I thought everyone did. So we'd go back to school after our summer vacation. And I'd say to my friends, so how many cathedrals did you see? And they sort of give me these blank looks. But Pa was very keen on us writing diaries. You know, a lot of parents, I think, encourage their kids to do that on holidays. They wanted us to write about the huge cannonballs that we'd seen and the campaniles, the church towers in Rome, and, you know, and just whatever the culture was, the Mona Lisa, anything that we'd seen. But actually, when he started looking at my diaries, they were just a list of everything that I'd eaten. That's what interested me. He thought he was the culture buff, and I was just writing about someone who I saw peeling artichokes in a square, or something that I'd seen on a skewer going past, running past us in Istanbul, or just anything really that we'd eaten in restaurants. And I'd do a little rubbish drawing, because I'm not a very good drawer, but just enough to jog my memory. And then over the years, I became a chef, and these sort of what was just sort of musings of a child became more focused as my food diaries. And that sort of became a part of travelling for me, was to go in and see as much as I could and record it in these diaries. I've now got about kind of 20 volumes over the last probably as many years.
Now, let's come back to the knife thing, because we haven't talked about that. But let's come back to it's sort of like, without even realizing it, your father exposed you to what it was you were interested in and therefore what you wanted to do when you grew up.
Yeah, I think, you know, Pa was a historian, and that's one side, history is one side of the culture of a country. And, you know, as you can tell from the book, I'm not just a chef who puts food on a plate. I like to understand where it comes from, why people use those ingredients in that part of the world, you know, what the significance of it. And so, he really taught me to look at food, even though he wasn't remotely interested in food, but the attitude, the similar way to how he looks at history, in that it's all, the story's all there. And the knives, really, that's just, I bought the first one back just accidentally from Turkey. We were going for a picnic when I was about 15.
That's your picnic knife,
yeah. Yeah, that's my Turkish picnic knife. And we were just going for a picnic with my mum and my dad and my sister, and we didn't have a knife. And so we've just picked this up in a little hardware store, and it's not a special knife at all, but it's probably one of my most loved ones. Anyway, it came back in the suitcase with us, and 25 years later, I still pick it up and use it, and it's a bit battered and wobbly, and I've got so many extraordinary knives from around the world that this looks like, it looks like a very common tool, but I love it enormously because it was where it all started for me.
Well, you know, all of your knives, one of the really great things, they all look used.
They are. And that's why I slightly hesitate at the word collect, you know, when people say I do collect knives, because there's something about a collection that sort of implies it's behind glass and not touched, whereas I keep all my knives in an enormous drawer in my kitchen. It's about sort of 3 foot square.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, it's half of my kitchen table, and it sort of slides underneath it. And they all come out. I use them all, because otherwise, just think, you know, things don't, that you need to use them in order for them to stay alive. And, well, except for maybe that Brazilian one for bone a pig's leg, because I never really got to grips with that one.
That's funny. Yeah. I should mention just at this juncture that people will find a lot of wit and humor in this book too. And in fact, I think I've been noticing a whole new category or tone or whatever you want to call it with all these cookbooks being produced. They've become more and more personalized to the chef or writer doing them, and more whimsical. I don't know if you've seen some of these new books, like the Life According to Joe Beef.
No, I haven't.
They have drawings, and they have instructions for assembling steamers or grills. I mean, just anything goes.
But whimsical's not a good word, is it, Anne?
Oh, yes, I think so. Yes, it depends whether I like whimsy.
Yeah. Oh, do you? No, I think in England, I think maybe something's changed in translation, because whimsical in England, that's not considered a good thing.
How is it considered in England? My English husband never mentioned it.
No, I think it's a nice word. I mean, it's a sort of a calmer way of saying eccentric.
It's not necessarily eccentric. It's celebrating that part of your sensibility that's
called whimsy.
Yeah. I was trying to think of that. We were just in Sicily, and I was trying to think of the word, and I couldn't think of how to explain it in Italian until later it dawned on me it's a capriccio. But see, that's one that has dubious associations.
Yeah.
Capricious, yeah.
Yeah. Now, to me, whimsical is kind of the hallmark card side of sentimentality.
Oh, God, no. I hate that sort of thing. Yeah.
Oh, good, 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 good. Because I was about to have to take objection.
No, you but, mustn't do that. You mustn't
this
do
is,
that.
I want to say part of this personalization is, well, of course, all these places, a big range of places. Where's the list? Turkey, New York, Burma, Milan, Oaxaca, Malawi, Hong Kong, Barcelona. And each segment, each chapter devoted to one of these, you have a bit about the country. And then you also, you have, which I thought was very personalized too, of course you have a picture of the knife. Then you have this like collage. Tell us about these collages.
Well, I'm a bit of a hoarder. When I go abroad, I like to bring things back that signify the place that I've been to me. But I want them, again, to be useful. And I like them to be, you know, things that I can use in the kitchen. So, for example, I've brought back an 8-pound stone pig, pestle and mortar, from Oaxaca in Mexico.
If I'd seen that, I'd have brought it back, too.
Oh, yeah.
I have a 40-pound statue from, where was it from? All the natives, from Tonga, natives who refer to it as my little brother.
Oh, yeah, so I just like to bring back things that sort of remind me of the trip, but that are useful in the culinary. So there may be pots or pans, there may be ingredients or spices, there may be booze. And generally, I like to bring a bottle of the local hooch, whatever that it would be, back with me, and obviously a knife as well. So, yeah, it's just to do with surrounding. I find that I'm better at recreating the recipes and the dishes that I've eaten there if I've got some things around me that are authentically from that. So either the pan that they were made in or some of the spices that they actually do use, as opposed to the ones that we would get imported or whatever it is. I just like to have some of the authentic flavors around.
Question for you: the sequence of the places doesn't seem to make any sense. Is it chronological?
Yes, okay. It did make sense, Pete.
The chronology isn't really clear, but that it is. The first places you went to are in the beginning, and the places you went to later are towards the end.
That's exactly right. I mean, I couldn't really think of how to do it, so I discussed it with my publisher, because I just had all these knives and I had all these recipes. Because the other thing about the food diaries and about the recipes in the book is that this is my fifth cookbook, but it's the first one that's not recipes that I've written. This is a book of all the best things that I've eaten around the world, taken out of my food diaries, and then I've gone home and recreated them in the kitchen. And normally it's quite interesting, because as a chef you start with the ingredients and you end up with the finished dish. Here I started with the finished dish already in my head. I knew what it tasted like, I knew what it looked like, and I was working backwards. So it's a very different experience writing this book.
Yeah, it's funny, we have a chef friend here in Pittsburgh. I'm thinking of Bill Fuller.
Big Burrito,
because you remember we really enjoyed his cooking after he got back from 4 months in Thailand.
Yes,
right. Oh, you lucky thing.
His girlfriend was in Thailand. So he went to join her in Thailand for several months, and when he came back, he was having fun playing around with the ingredients that found there for the first time. And we just loved the things that he put on the plate. He's now, I think, returned to more normal cooking, because he's executive chef of a big restaurant empire. But we love Bill's cooking best when he was doing exactly, if you like, what you're doing. Now, this is a book at another level as well, because it's an adventure story. So I never got to finish the story of what happened in San Francisco after somebody stole your knife.
Oh, that was
the knives. That was a shame.
Yeah, it was terrible.
My heart broke when I read that.
Oh, no, I know. Well, I do. There's a lot of heart in this book, isn't there, Anne? But no, that was a terrible day, because I was working two jobs at the data shift in Rubicon, just at the bottom of the tower there.
Yeah.
Sure, we know it well.
Oh, right. And then doing the evening shift at Jardiniere. And
I love Tracy.
Tracy's excellent and a great cook.
Yeah, she's
very
a good friend.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And I was just catching the bus, and I was tired, because, you know, there's a long day. I was doing the butcher's shift in the morning as well at Rubicon. So it was an early start and a late finish. And I guess I was just sort of, you know, not really concentrating on the bus, you know, waiting at the bus stop. And when the bus pulled up, I looked down and my knife roll had gone. And I was just like, you know, and I was tired and I was 6,000 miles from home, and I just cried and cried.
Aww.
Just like, because your knives, you know, I mean, as you can tell, I'm passionate about my knives. And even at that time, they were like, you know, they were my weapons of creation. you know, and my collection, even though it was only very nascent at that time, just a budding collection of things that I picked up. Most of them were just my college knives from the Cordon Bleu, but a few bits and pieces along the way, just giving it a characterful tone, making it mine. And the whole lot was gone, and I was just
devastated.
So when I got my next paycheck, I went straight down to Japantown, which I thought was very exotic, because everywhere's got a Chinatown, but I'd never seen anywhere with a Japantown before. And obviously in Japantown, there was going to be a good knife shop. Picked myself out that one with the holes all along the blade, because I needed just a fairly conventional, you know, a useful knife, just a straightforward chef's knife. But being me, I couldn't buy just a regular knife. So I bought like this one with, and I call it my San Francisco suction-free chef's knife, because
right.
The idea is if you do your very precise Japanese chopping, the bits of vegetables don't stick to the side and they just drop off, and so you get a better chop. I've never really found it to work particularly well, but I still love that knife and I use it a lot.
You know, some of the interesting, well, I thought the Filipino section was really interesting, probably because I'm not that familiar with the Philippine cuisine, although a friend of mine had a Philippine restaurant. She did healthy Philippine, so that wouldn't qualify altogether, I don't think.
Yeah, that's not, it's not a very, they do love a fryer over in the Philippines.
Yeah. So is it maybe just because I don't know this culture at all or cuisine, but they're really fascinating recipes in this section. This by way of pointing out that not only is it on a personal memoir level interesting, but you have fabulous recipes in here too.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I mean, as I said, this is when I realized that I was going to do this book, when I kept this book from my food diaries, because I'd never written the diaries with a view to doing a book from them. They were just to what I was interested in, and then as I went into being a chef, just sort of things that I could take home so I could, you know, recreate them. And then I did actually look, and I thought, no, this is going to be a book. And on my short list of recipes, best things I'd eaten around the world, I had 560, I think it was, from things that I pulled out just in my first draft. And you know, this is quite a big book anyway, and this has got 123 recipes in it.
So you had to cut a lot of them, huh?
Yeah, I had to, yeah.
How did you find Cuba?
I found Cuba, to be honest, I found it slightly sad. America's got quite a complicated relationship with Cuba.
Right.
We British have a slightly more straightforward one. Yeah, but it had that sort of slight, you know, don't go there. What think about it as being quite a party town, lots of rum, lots of dancing, slightly, just quite a fun place to be, particularly Havana. And actually when I went there, it was so crucifyingly poor. I mean, the people were just so poor. You know, the whole economy, there is no economy to speak of. You know, the street lights don't work, so the whole town is just dark after, you know, 8 o'clock once the sun goes down, and it gives it a very eerie feel. Buildings are falling down, the municipal building. I mean, there were lovely things there, and I can see why Hemingway fell in love with it, and, you know, there was extraordinary things to see.
Did you get to taste the, did you go into people's homes to taste the cuisine?
Yeah, so what they do is they have, being a communist country, they have state-run restaurants, but then the government allows people, in a way to supplement their income, to literally open their front rooms, and these are called paladares. And you're only allowed to have 4 tables, that's the maximum, so you can sort of get another, you know, whatever, 10 people through or 20 people through of an evening. But then you literally get to eat, you know, mama's home cooking, because you're eating in their front rooms, which is a very strange experience, but the food in the paladares is definitely best state-run restaurants, which are a bit grim, to be honest. Have you been there?
No, I mean, you know, we haven't been able to go for years and years and years.
Yeah,
actually.
Are they going to change that? Do you think?
I think it's going to happen. And the good news for Cuba is that there are literally billions of development dollars available once that will happen. Somebody has to make a move. And our current president has enough on his plate, I guess, that it's not on the front burner. I think if the Castro brother came forward and said, we will make this change if you will remove your embargo and allow development to take place, I think that would happen. At some point, I would guess in the next decade, it will change anyway.
Said so. And I think Raul is going to be a bit more open to than
Well,
than
we do have a lot of friends, though, who have managed to get there. a doctor friend who takes some medical supplies all the time.
Yeah, every time he goes, right?
Yeah.
Right, but so, in that, one of my favorite recipes in the book is in that chapter, the Cuba and the Caribbean chapter, that rabbit lasagna.
I was looking at that.
It's so yummy.
I told Peter about it. We have a rabbit or two in our freezer.
We have two.
Yeah. Well, it's a bit of a make. There are some very good short recipes in the book, but this is one of the longer ones. It's a bit of a, this is for the people who really do love cooking. So, don't try and knock it up just for if you're hungry for dinner that night. You have to work a little bit ahead. Okay. But usually, if you're going to have a, not most people don't have a rabbit in their freezer like you. But it is so yummy, and I had that in one of the most famous paladares in Havana called La Guarida, and it was just mind blowingly good. And it actually, when I was doing this thing of having to recreate exactly how it tastes. And sometimes I haven't got any notes on.
I didn't ask you that. I mean, do you ask people for recipes?
Well, I don't generally ask them for recipes. I mean, I'll make my own tasting notes. I'll make a list of ingredients or, you know, jot down the important flavors. But sometimes, you know, it takes a while to. I mean, I made this rabbit lasagna, I would have said about a dozen times till I was absolutely happy that it was as good a reflection as I'd had in Havana.
And you know what else we have in our freezer is malva pudding.
Oh, have you?
Yes. We do. There's
a woman in California
who makes it. Yeah.
You have to make this recipe. It's a very easy recipe, but my goodness, it's such a good dish. Maybe it's a good Thanksgiving pudding.
We were very fortunate. The ones we got were already prepared and they were frozen, and all we had to do was thaw them out. But it is a wonderfully cloying dessert.
It's quite sweet, but my goodness, it's delicious.
Now, I want to change tack for just a second because we can't let you go with all your knowledge of dining in England and especially in London without asking you about that. So the book is a fascinating story. Listeners, you'll be sure to enjoy it. Bought, borrowed, and stolen doesn't really explain just how insightful and interesting the contents are in this book. But during your culinary career, you helped to found a small chain of restaurants in London called Leon.
Oh, I think of it as a large chain.
It's the
difference between you and me, I guess, Peter.
Well, they have, about 8 or 10?
Yeah, I think we're up to 11 now.
I wanted to mention, because one of the things that's difficult to do in London is to find really good food at a reasonable price. And Leon does just such a wonderful job of that, that I wanted to make sure that I got that into our conversation. And thank you and your colleagues for founding that group so that that's available. But I was going to ask you, before you sign off, there are some particular places in London that you really like, whether they're on the beaten track or off the beaten track. First of all, selfishly for our benefit, because we'll get to hear it first.
Absolutely.
And we're planning to go early next year. Listeners in general, I'm sure, will be very interested in your suggestions. Could you pick maybe three or four that you really like?
Sure. I think the best Italian to be eaten in London, because we have fantastic Italian restaurants like the River Cafe, but there's a guy opened up called Jacob Kennedy, and his restaurant is called Bocca del Lupo.
His cookbook.
Oh, yeah. We tried to get in there last year, and we never managed to establish contact.
In fact, I haven't been able to set up an interview.
Right.
He's very elusive.
Okay. Bocca del Lupo.
Fantastic. It's really worth a visit. And to me, actually, that's one of the better cookbooks, because, you know, obviously chefs, we're very fussy about our book. And I think that's a great cookbook.
Yeah, well,
do you like it?
We did. We liked the book. We liked everything we heard about the restaurant. The problem we had was trying to figure out how we could establish communication, because our job isn't just to dine. Our job is to try to capture an interview with the chef as well. And that we never made that work.
Okay, that's a shame.
So that's one.
We'll get back on it.
Try a couple. Oh, we'll try again for next year.
Yeah, absolutely. Put it on the list. Ring ahead. Polpo. Did you know Polpo and Da Polpo?
That falls in the same category. I had it
no,
on.
No, it's a much cheaper.
No, no. When I say it falls in the same category, it falls in the same category for my processing purposes. I found out about it, I read about it, and I tried to include them in last year's itinerary. And again, for whatever reason, I was never able to make a connection.
So he's got. This is a guy called Russell Norman, who has got now three restaurants. There's Polpo. no, four. Da Polpo, so Polpo, Da Polpo, Spuntina, and then he's just opening a new one as well. So I mean, I would just get into any of them that you can. I think you'd really enjoy that. Wolfgang Puck has just opened up on Park Lane, rather hilariously. I went in there last week.
I
mean, it was interesting. To be honest, I don't think it translates very well to England. And personally, I had a small objection to bringing over American beef to England. I mean, I love American beef. I'll eat American beef when I'm in America and enjoy it very much indeed. But he had Wagyu from Australia, the USDA from America, and one from Devon down in the West Country of England.
Okay. We've had Red Devon and we really like it. Michael,
it's delicious meat. And if you've got Red Devon down the road, why on earth are you bringing over beef from America and Australia?
Well, how about this Thomas Keller pop-up?
In Harrods.
At Harrods. He brought everything, not just his staff, but every ingredient. He brought it
up. I just think in the world, that's just not a great way to... I mean, I've totally admired Thomas Keller, and I had one of the best meals of my life at Per Se last year or the year before. But, I mean, personally, you know, we've got great food in England.
Yeah.
Work with what we've got rather than shipping it all over or flying it all over, which is more...
We agree with you completely. We would never go there. Now, we did go to Daniel Ballou's Bar Ballou last year, and we thought that was exceptional.
Yeah, that was very good. Yeah, that is good. That's a good place as well. And there's another, probably my choice of steak place in London would be called Hawksmoor. That's a new one. And we've got, do you know Yotam Ottolenghi?
No. Oh, I know the name.
Right. He's got a new restaurant called Noppi, N-O-P-I, that I think you should check out as well. He does amazing ingredients pairings. It's kind of, it's not fusion food, but he puts things together. He's got a huge arsenal of ingredients that he uses. And he puts them together in such an interesting way. I think he's one of the most interesting. He's Israeli-born, but lives in London. And he's just fantastic with vegetarian food. I'm a bit of a genius. And one more, do you know Peter Gordon?
We do. It took us 5 years to connect with Providoras.
Right, and he's got this second one now called Corpapa. Which is a lovely restaurant just right by Seven Dials in Covent Garden.
Oh, well, that's great. Well, I'll have to bring him back onto the front burner again.
It might only take another five years
to get there.
We're good buddies with one of his proteges who has...
Chef called Brad Farmer, who has a restaurant, several restaurants, but one called Public in New York City, which is his flagship.
Well, we could talk and talk and
we
talk.
We could.
You have a full day, I understand. You're here for the sole purpose of promoting this book, and let's mention again that it's called Bought, Borrowed, and Stolen.
And I'm just going to explain why, because people
are going to say we haven't done that yet.
No, it's just a little... Please explain it.
Well, it's because, you know, now that you get the whole premise behind the book, the knives are bought and the recipes are borrowed and stolen because they're not my recipes. They're just things that I've eaten from around the world. Yeah, when I was working on the book, in my head, I always called it my knife book, but the publishers, you know, I said I'm working on my knife book, but the publishers just said that wasn't going to fly, and so I had to think of something else, and I just thought I'd go with something a little bit esoteric. But, you know, it's a little clunky, but it's working.
Well, maybe we'll catch up with you in London. We'll certainly be in touch and let you know when we're going to be there. And in the meantime, thank you so much for joining us today on The Menu.
And Peter, thank you so much for having me on.
To Allegra.
See you in London.
Yes.
If you get the feeling that Allegra is someone you'd like to hang out with and have adventures with, I think you got the right idea. We're certainly going to try and catch up with her the next time in London, and I'm sure there'll be an adventure when we do that. But now it's time to take another break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Our next guest is catching up with an old friend, more or less. This man is so prodigious and so prolific as a cookbook author. It's James Villas, and let me tell you, you wonder why didn't we think about this. It's called Ground Meat all over the world. It's called Ground Up is the book. You can always count on James Villas coming up with an absolutely extraordinary concept for a new book, and he's done it again. This one's called From the Ground Up. Welcome to On the Menu once again, James.
Good to be back here, Ann.
Now, you said that this sort of came to you as a concept resulting from your travels.
Right.
Tell us about that.
Well, of course, I've always loved any kind of anything ground. I think everybody does. If you really put it on the wall, I don't know anyone who doesn't like a ground meat, especially dish. And I certainly grew up on a lot of them. I had to do a lot of traveling when I was at Town and Country. I was there 27 years and was constantly traveling the world. And one day it dawned on me. It didn't really dawn on me one day. I was actually talking to Craig Claiborne when Craig was still alive. And one night he was here at the house, and I gave him the old cliche question, Craig, favorite dish in the world if you were in front of a firing squad. And without blinking an eye, Craig said, anything ground.
Oh, how funny.
And I thought about that later, and then I began thinking about French quenelles that I'd had, and Greek dolmades, and Cornish pasties, and a vast Italian crostini, and English rissoles, and that sort of thing, Moroccan bistilla. And I said, hey, there's a whole global world out there of ground dishes that Americans just don't know about. Why not do a whole book on it?
And this is a big book.
Yeah, and
small print. But you probably had to be careful what you included.
Sure I did.
Because otherwise the book would have been three times the size.
Actually, Peter, the book was 50 pages longer.
Okay.
They had to cut it down.
They did. But
I had to cut it down 50 pages, which infuriated me because I had to do all those recipes, you know. But anyway.
You had to throw all the recipes
away.
Well,
you never throw away because I'm always rehashing things, you know.
But then there you are. You're doing sausages again.
Yeah, well, why not?
And as I said to you before we came on the air, what could possibly be wrong with a cookbook that has rissoles, kedgeree?
Oh, wow.
But you said you don't have faggots in there, but we did discuss the fact that a faggot is really like a vertical rissole.
Vertical rissole.
Well, it is. Depends on, you know, I've seen faggots done in so many different ways.
Well, the thing about it that sticks in my memory the most is that you bought your faggots pre-formed, pre-cooked and everything at the butcher shop. So the butcher would have them on display.
Yeah, that I've heard about. I haven't seen that myself, but I've heard about that.
Like those pork pies that
used to buy. Like pork pies or like...
Well, you still see those everywhere.
You do indeed. And,
oh, yeah.
And we discovered... Just the other day, just slightly off the subject, we were interviewing a really nice lady called Michelle, who's from upstate New York somewhere, I think. And she has a pie shop, mostly making sweet pies, but she makes an Australian meat pie.
Oh, yeah, right.
And she has homesick Australians from all over the region coming to buy them.
I wish I'd known about that pie.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah.
What's the name of that Australian pie?
It's just called a meat pie.
Just like the Canadian is, they call the tortilla meat pie.
Yeah, now.
But I would have loved to have had an Australian dish, and I didn't know about that.
I think Michelle calls it a beef pie, but
right.
I think truly it's like a mystery meat pie.
But I love those concepts of those small pies, or what I think they used to call raised pies.
Okay.
Yeah, in England.
My mother used to call it, if you got a large pie, it was called a stand pie.
Yeah, so, I've heard of that also.
So you would have a pie for the whole family.
Right.
That would serve eight people, assuming that you didn't want more than one small piece to go around.
You know, Peter, if you go through that shop in Harrods, they must have four counters of pies in
those. Oh, yes, absolutely, absolutely.
And they're just, you know, they're luscious, all of them. I just love them.
They have national competitions for who makes the best of these.
Right.
This mystery dish called pork pie.
We used to have it every Christmas.
But anyway, for those people who are like you and me, I love sausages too. I don't believe in Oliver Wendell Holmes saying that there are two things she should not be seen making, laws and sausages.
My mother used to say that, actually.
Yeah, well, she's quoting him. I think she's quoting him.
Back to this book, I think that we should note that addition to beef, which we've been talking about, there's chicken, pork, seafood, and other things even that are included. It's not all like meat.
See, and that's the main idea, is that I don't think Americans have ever conceived of seafood being ground. And there's just so many wonderful ground seafood dishes.
Yes.
Oh, David, is it Shortuck, Chanterelle, sadly now closed in New York?
Yeah,
that's very sad.
He made the most wonderful, sublime seafood sausage, which is very like the recipe you describe in your book.
He's opening.
And you know, Peter, those were very fashionable back in the 70s.
Yeah. Is he opened again?
He's opening something. It's not at all like...
Ian Karen, I don't think they've opened a restaurant. I think it's just a place that they're cooking food.
Okay.
We had a wonderful evening there.
Oh, they were classic. They absolutely... I was there when they opened the restaurant, and I was very depressed when they had to shut it.
Yeah, that's pretty depressing.
I don't blame them, though. I really don't.
Oh, yeah. We were there, I think, in the spring, and they were going to be celebrating their anniversary in the fall, and then they closed them.
Yeah, they never made it to 30, did they?
Let me go back to this list of contents here so that the readers get a full picture of all that this book encompasses, because this is a lot of information here. Appetizers, canapés and dips, soups and salads, sandwiches and turnovers, patties, balls and dumplings, loaves, croquettes and cakes, pies, quiches and souffles, casseroles and pastas, hashes and chilies, stuffed dishes and forcemeats, sausage and sauces. Quite a lot to cover.
Quite a big territory, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
And see, people don't realize that.
Yeah, who would think of me? If you asked me to think of a ground beef dish, I'd
It's a whole world to itself. Yes. It's a world of cooking.
Yeah, and see, I've, all the time we spent in Barcelona, I never had the shredded seafood salad.
Oh, those are wonderful.
What are some of your favorite things that... Did you just stop?
A lot. For example, the empanadas. Certainly none about empanadas when I traveled in South America, but a lot of those empanadas I didn't know about before I really began researching this and doing some testing. And I didn't love empanadas that much. Now, I like them. I like them a great deal now. I really do.
How about arepas from Venezuela?
No, I don't have that.
You have to do a volume two.
Yeah, you have to do a volume two.
Oh, no, but there is a style of cooking in there that I'm trying to bring back, Peter, and that is croquettes.
Okay, yep.
I grew up on croquettes, and my God, I love any kind of croquettes, you know, and it's almost disappeared.
Along with city chicken. Is that in the book?
No, I don't think so.
No.
That's another one. I don't know. Is that regional or is that?
Oh, and there are really hundreds and hundreds of these dishes. That's, well,
I hated this stuff. It was ground up.
I mean, like you say, it's a big, fat book, but the book could have been doubled easily.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sure it could.
Yeah, just the fritters and the croquettes, for example. I could have gone on and on and on with those things.
Well, now, you didn't stay geographically anywhere close to the United States. I mean, you roamed the world.
Well, that's the whole idea.
And here's some southern things in here.
Oh, yeah. I didn't say there weren't American things in here. There are lots of British things in here, because the British love to grind things up.
And I've got plenty of southern stuff in there, too, that I grew up on.
Yeah, yeah, and if you grind it up, no one will know what it is.
I grew up in an American Swedish Greek family, so that really gave me.
Right.
Oh, man.
I keep forgetting about the Greek. I didn't know about the Swedish.
I mean, I sat at a table where Swedish and Greek and English were spoken. Oh, yeah, and all those foods were cooked in my house, in my mother's house. To me, something like a dolmades is just is standard for me as a hamburger.
Yeah.
Or the Swedish, there's a great dish called beef lindström.
Yeah.
Not to mention Swedish meatballs. Now, that's something Americans do know about, is Swedish meatballs.
Oh, yeah, thanks,
they do,
IKEA.
They do.
Well, I grew up on Swedish meat. I had some Swedish meatballs last night, as a matter of fact.
Now, did you bake them to your own recipe?
No.
No, okay.
No.
We have the Swedish friends in southern Spain, and so many Swedes have settled there that they have a Swedish restaurant that actually serves the traditional Christmas feast, and we went to that one. It's a big buffet.
Oh, that's something.
It was something.
And they had many Swedish meatballs.
They had lots of Swedish meatballs.
Well, Swedes always, just like my grandmother married a Greek, loved to go to those warm climates because it's so damn cold up there.
Now, one of the interesting things that you've done is to include in here dishes that are made up of meat that isn't typically ground, like chicken and turkey.
Right.
I can no more imagine me growing up in England and my mother actually handling ground turkey or ground chicken. I mean, ground beef is bad enough.
Well, the irony about ground chicken and ground turkey is if we'd been having this conversation 20 years ago, I would have had to tell you, Peter, you've got to get your own meat grinder, which I still want you to do. Huh. But today, all of the stores are full of ground turkey and ground chicken.
I understand.
They're everywhere. They're in all supermarkets now.
Now, I have a little difficulty with, I must confess, I have a little difficulty with ground chicken.
I'm wary.
And maybe you've got a tip for me, because we got a great book from the Loeb brothers, the butchers on Madison Avenue, New York.
They're the best.
They're really wonderful butchers, and they have a recipe, which I make frequently, which is supposedly composed of 50% ground veal and 50% ground chicken. And I've tried it with that combination, and to me it's too wet. The chicken has too much moisture in it, so I make it with all veal.
Well, that shouldn't be like that.
So the secret is to grind it yourself?
Grinding yourself is the best, even your own hamburger, it's going to be better. And there's so many wonderful new grinders today that are safe-proof. I mean, they're already fail-proof. The grinder that I use the most people wouldn't touch, it was my grandmother's grinder. And it clamps on a table. And it, manual and you crank a handle and so forth.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
That's what we used to have when my mother made sausage.
Yeah, you attach it to the side of the table, right?
And I still use that thing. People laugh at me, you know, but I mean, I have a very good electric grinder, you know, it does a beautiful job, but I don't think it comes out ever as good as that old-fashioned grinding in my hand.
Electric one would not, you know,
well, it would tend to grind it too fast.
Right, and also
heat up the meat.
When I talk about this book, I always warn people, there's no doubt about it, the food processor is a miracle. But you've got to be very, very careful with food processors, because you can turn this stuff into mush in no time. The food processor is great for grind, as long as you zap correctly and watch very carefully what you're doing. Now, I would not ever grind chicken probably in a food processor.
Okay.
For the reason Speed is talking about, because it tends to liquefy so quickly, and you end up with a mess before you know.
Okay, so that's the answer. See, I was buying it across the counter at Whole Foods.
Well, it makes sense. It's much easier to buy it, and it's safe today for the most part, even though I'm very careful about those. I mean, I always look for what's called the pull date on that and make sure that, because you're talking about a product here that has surface space like no other foods.
Yes, yes, yeah.
And can spoil very, very quickly.
No, I understand completely.
Well, what was your biggest discovery in this, your new best favorite ground thing?
My best discovery in this book. I'll tell you, I think, I'm a southerner, and I created Americans Love Burgers. And I said, everyone loves a beef burger, why not come up with a pork burger, but not just a pork burger using shoulder, which I love. And it's so moist, and there's so much flavor, and the right amount of fat and everything, but put some crackling in there.
Oh, wow.
The way you've got the contrast of that crunch and that velvety softness in a burger, that is one of the greatest things you've ever put in your mouth.
Yeah, oh, my goodness. That sounds great. All you got to do is be able to get the pork crackling to cook in the first place.
Well, all you do is get some pork fat and render your own pork fat down to crackling. It takes 5-10 minutes.
Okay.
And then on top of it, on the soft, and put them on a soft bun, and on top of that, I put caramelized onions. Now, you talk about something that's good.
That sounds good.
When can we have that, James? Let's have that.
Yeah, what are we having for dinner tonight?
Probably fish.
Yeah, we're having fish.
And one thing we haven't even mentioned about this book, another reason I did this book is because these are tough times we're living in, and I don't know of any book that addresses economy like this book does. This is the way to go if you want to save money. You can save a lot of money by cooking like this.
I think the biggest waste is nobody ever does anything with chicken gizzards. I love chicken gizzards. I love chicken gizzards.
I love chicken gizzards, and I've got a Italian crostinian that uses the livers and the gizzards and the livers, you know, that it's absolute to die for.
Oh, right. Is that in this book?
Yes, and nothing is more ideal and for grinding than something like chicken gizzards. Now, those grind beautifully as opposed to your more elegant cuts of chicken. But since they're so tough, they grind beautifully.
Oh, wow. I like that.
Whereas livers don't.
No, livers, just if you do that, it just gets mushy, right?
They do get mushy. Never grind a liver until you've sauteed it for a few minutes.
Yeah, do you do that? I just saw some Austrian.
Yeah.
Oh, you have gefilte fish? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you got to have gefilte fish. Yeah. What's more American?
Yeah.
Today it's considered American.
Here's something from the past, Salisbury steak.
And you know, oh, my God, that is in the same category of family as far as I'm concerned with croquettes. Whatever happened to a great Salisbury steak, which, don't forget, is the ancestor of the hamburger?
Uh-huh. Well, I can tell you what happened to me in the dormitory at the University of Michigan.
No, we don't need to go there.
I bit into my Salisbury steak and got a nail in my tongue.
Oh, my Lord.
No, they didn't have the...
And probably no dish was ever abused more than Salisbury steak.
Unless it was Rizzoles.
Because it's the same category as Rizzoles, and for the same reasons. It happened in America, and that is, nothing was worse than these steaks were made with canned gravy, soup mixes, all this gloppy stuff, you know, and therefore maybe that's the reason it fell out of favor, but a great Salisbury steak, and I got a good recipe in the book for you. Follow that recipe and you'll love it.
But I can't believe that the 19th century English used shiitake mushrooms in Salisbury steak.
No, I think this is the
gems. No, not the 19th century.
No, but I was just wondering how much you really doctored up these traditional recipes.
Oh, sure. Well, like I say, and I'm always playing with food. And anything that's got mushrooms today as opposed to 30 years ago, I will certainly consider cremini and shiitakes and wild mushrooms instead of button mushrooms.
Sure.
Just because they've got more flavor. And they're so available now.
Well, James, we know you'll be back soon. because you'll, because you'll have another exciting project to talk to us about. In the meantime,
I can tell you what it is now.
Go ahead.
Southern fried.
Southern fried.
Oh, wow.
Okay, well, so what?
This is the infamous food that we are known for, the fried food that make us so fat and everything, and I want to disprove all of those myths. I don't know anyone who doesn't love fried food.
That's a good idea.
And I'm going to, this whole book is based on the whole idea of, okay, I'm going to show you that in the South how we know how to fry food.
Well, I just heard that Paula Deen was diagnosed with diabetes.
I have a projection. Since you mentioned Paula Deen, I have a secretly James Villas is auditioning to take over from Paula Deen.
No, Lord. I knew Paula when she was still a recluse.
A recluse? Paula?
Yeah, well,
wow.
Well, you'll be coming out of reclusion, and you can stand next to Matt Lauer and...
I'm too busy writing novels.
Well, Jim, thank you once again.
It's always wonderful talking
to you. So good to talk with you all again.
Yeah, James, thanks.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And we'll be back with you same time, same place next week. We'll hope to see you then.
Bye-bye.